Welcome back to Understanding VC. I'm your host, Rahul. Today, my guest is Sheel Munot. Sheel is a co-founder and partner at Better Tomorrow Ventures, a VC fund based in San Francisco, investing in seed-stage fintech startups around the world. Sheel's exclusive focus on fintech dates back to 2015, following a couple of successful fintech exits. He's also co-founded the podcast, The Pitch, which was acquired by Gimlet Media. Now, let's talk to him. Hi, Sheel. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Rahul, for having me.
So I noticed that you just got married. Congrats on getting married to on Metaverse.
Thank you. Yeah. Just happened a couple of days ago.
And it's super cool that your grandmother also joined. The thing that I've noticed about grandmothers is that if it's something that would allow them to connect with their kids or grandkids, they usually pick up any technology.
Exactly. Yeah. She was very excited to be a part of it.
Yeah. I already listened to a lot of your podcasts, so I kind of know that you are from Pittsburgh and then your mom wanted you to become a doctor. So what did you want to do growing up?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a traditional Indian family, parents are always interested in their kids becoming doctors, especially in the United States. So mine was no different. I think me personally, I always knew I wanted to be in business. And I also always had a love for technology. So early on, you know, I hounded my parents to buy me a computer at a young age, loved everything about technology and connecting with humans through technology. So it's always been a part of my life. So I would say I didn't necessarily know that I wanted to be a venture capitalist, but I wanted to be in business and I wanted to be in technology. So, you know, it's not that far off from what I always knew.
Yeah. And in terms of hobbies growing up, what were your hobbies?
Yeah, so I think I spend a lot of time, you know, on the computer. But otherwise, I grew up loving sports. I grew up in Pittsburgh, which is a sports town. And so the Steelers were my number one. And then, you know, just spending a lot of time with friends outside. So I would go biking, hiking, all that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. And, you know, you spent a year in India working for a nonprofit. That was very interesting. I've heard you mention this, that you lived on $1 a day. It reminded me of a movie. So I'm from Kerala in India, and yeah, there was this movie called ABCD, which is an acronym for American Born,
yeah,
Confused Desi. And so what happens in the movie is that the main actor's father, they are from a rich family in US, and they trick this guy to coming into India and then cut off his, you know, credit cards so that he's forced to live on a very small monthly allowance of like $1 a day to kind of, you know, make sure that he has a real life MBA. So kind of reminded
That's
me
cool.
of your story.
And I did it on my own. I didn't need to be forced into it.
Yeah. You know, you were in microfinance. So what do you think is the impact of access to credit, especially in a low income country like India?
Yeah, I think it's hugely impactful. I think, you know, many of the poor in India and around the world, the problem is really smoothing consumption. So if you're a farmer or something, you make all of your money at a particular time in the year, and then you kind of starve the rest of the year. And credit can help smooth that process. And you can also, you know, the working poor in India are mostly sort of small business owners, and credit can help build their business.
Yeah.
So get an irrigation pump or fertilizer for your crops and your farm, or buy land, all kinds of other stuff you can do.
And this has direct impact on the earnings and a better life. Is it proven?
Yeah, I think I don't have any of the latest data, but certainly, you know, when I was working in microfinance 15 years ago, there were lots of studies done. And yeah, it has great impact on people.
Yeah. And also, I know you've finally decided to become a VC, and I've heard you mention that it's mostly because of the joy of helping founders, but is there more to it in the sense, like, you know, you spend, like, you've used a lot of your personal wealth in, you know, investing in startups early on to build a track record. So why do such a thing?
Yeah. So I would say I really just enjoy it. I think, you know, life's too short to not do what you enjoy. Yeah. Now, it happens to be that what I enjoy is also a lucrative and promising career. But for me, it starts with just doing what I enjoy. And I enjoy helping companies at the early stages. I enjoy sort of building our own company, you know, VC fund. It's just a joy. And that's why I'm doing this first and foremost.
And you know, I've heard you talk about a lot about ownership. So I'd like to really go deep in on ownership. You talk about the minimum 10% ownership that you guys like to have when you invest in at a seed stage. So does ownership really matter, especially if you know a startup has a potential to generate gigantic returns?
Yeah, so I think you know a lot of people think about it from a like, oh, why would ownership matter? Why not just have more bets and small ownership in each? I think what they're missing is to be a good VC, you spend a lot of time with the company. And so if I'm going to spend time with the company, I need to own a significant portion of the company for it to be worth my time. If I own 1-2%, then like it's hard to make the math work on my time. So, you know, we really want to be true partners in the business and as hands-on and helpful as possible. So yeah, ownership is important.
Yeah, but so there might be some cases where you see something, this has potential to be like a giant company, then would you miss out? Like, would you pass on an investment like that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think, you know, if we're a lead investor almost always. So if we can't be a lead investor, then yeah, it's not a fit for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really hard to say something. I mean, there's nothing I've ever seen at seed where I said, oh, this is a sure thing. It's going to be a big outcome. There's no such thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Also one other thing then. So what if the company needs, you know, to get to the next milestone, it needs a lot more capital than average company, then would you compromise on the valuation?
No, quite the opposite. If it needs a lot of capital, then they're going to constantly be more and more diluted over time. So I'm not interested.
Yeah. So the thing that you talk about as like not wanting to invest in businesses that are not capital efficient, that's also around the same theme of like a lot more dilution and less ownership.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. Yeah. It's like over time, they're constantly in fundraising mode. It's not a good place to be.
Yeah. Any other reason why those are not good businesses?
I mean, it's not that they can't be good businesses. It's just, I think, you know, that's the challenge, is you're constantly diluted in those businesses.
Yeah. And one last thing around valuations, right? So second time founders, they might think that, why would I take a lower valuation? Especially, I have done this thing before. I mean, your pitch is usually, we've done this before and we'll help you with the company building aspects. And so how does second time founders react to that? I can understand convincing first time founders would be easy.
Yeah, you know, it's actually interesting. It's an interesting question. I think we actually do better with second time founders because I think they've seen who is actually helpful, who is not. And so our win rate with second time founders is very, very higher than it is with first time founders. I think first time founders, it's easy to get attracted to a brand name, and then whereas the second time founders have been through it before and they know they can do their own homework on who's actually helpful.
Ah, interesting. Okay. And I've heard you mention that you're a hands-on investor. So curious to know, and you spoke about putting in the time to help the portfolio startups. At what point or what scenarios would you like give up on a portfolio startup?
So like, how do we help? Is that the question?
You know, the question is like, would you give up so on a particular
startup?
Oh,
would I quit being an investor and go?
I mean, you can't quit, right? So you just like mentally give up and not support.
Oh, when do you give up on a company?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has happened for sure. And it's when time and time again, they don't listen to feedback or react. This is not to say that we're always right. But there are some times when we can see something clearly and we help the founder try to prevent making a mistake or have them move faster or whatever. And then they don't at any point. That becomes difficult. But I would say we've never given up on a company and that we, you know, we always are still try to be helpful, but maybe not with our money.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of like the companies that you're interested to look at in fintech, what would that be at the moment? And what do you think are going to be like big businesses in this decade?
Yeah, so we tend to not be as focused on having specific themes we invest behind. We tend to be much more opportunistic, meaning we look at each individual company as it comes in and make an assessment there. You know, recent trends that we've invested in include sort of helping banks get better. We've invested in embedded fintech. So we have an embedded banking company called Unit. We have an embedded payroll company called Salsa. And we're looking at a couple other things right now. We've done some stuff in the fraud space. So I'd say we've done a lot more infrastructure than we have done consumer stuff.
Yeah. Infrastructure is usually more profitable and could lead to bigger outcome, right? In general.
In general, yeah, that's true.
So when you say embedded finance, it's more like companies. So I think Unit is a company that helps anybody build a neobank.
That's right. Yes.
And talking about neobanks, so I use Revolut, if you know them. And one thing that I've noticed is that, you know, I don't use this Revolut as my main bank account. So I still use DBS, which is the big bank here in Singapore, as my main account. And I use Revolut as my, you know, expense account.
Yeah.
I love the user experience. You know, you can create virtual cards, you can create temporary cards, you can see a lot of the stats of your usage and stuff like that. It's wonderful user experience. But I kind of feel that, you know, all these neobanks are not able to achieve the level of trust that a traditional bank has managed to or already has. Is this a problem that you see? And usually the neobanks partner with a traditional bank because they don't have a banking license. So then other than the user experience, I don't see any other value at.
I mean, I think saying other than the user experience is, you know, user experience is worth a lot. And, you know, making life easy is often a function of just user experience. User experience is means a lot. So I think that is the big piece of it. There are other products that, you know, United States Chime pays you early on your salary. I think that's really important in this environment.
Yeah, it's kind of like earned wage access kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. And what is stopping these neobanks from really competing with the traditional banks at the moment?
I think you're right. Like, trust is a big issue. And it's trust and distribution. And so the banks already have distribution. Everybody's heard of the brands, et cetera. And, you know, those guys have done a really, it's taken generations to build that trust and brand. So they have it. And it's hard for a neobank to get started, even a well-capitalized one, to build that brand.
And do you think it also has to do with, you know, almost all neobanks, they don't have any branches. So they don't have people that they can talk to. And it's all through an app. Is that a reason?
Very few people go to the branch anymore. But people feel comfort and trust in knowing that there's a branch nearby. So, you know, in the United States, more than 10 years ago, Bank of America started converting some of their branches into ATMs only. They weren't actually staffed, but they looked like branches. So people felt like, oh, there's a branch nearby.
Yeah. One last thing. It's year 2030. Where would you want to be? And where would you want Better Tomorrow Ventures to be?
Yeah, look, I think we want to be known as the best choice, the number one choice that any founder building a fintech company would want as an investor. Yeah. And I think we want to be true partners and have a reputation as such. So I think that's what I would say.
And I mean, how do you plan to get there? Your plan would be to communicate this through these interactions or working with founders one-on-one, or do you have plans to have like a platform approach or anything else?
Yeah, so we have a platform. So we have a talent partner on our team. We have people who are just focused on helping the portfolio. Yeah. And I think beyond that, it goes with everyone we hire. So it's not like somebody's, you know, although we have the platform, it's really about every person we bring on the team. And everybody knows that they're aligned in being the founder's first choice and doing everything we can to keep that up.
but also your core value proposition, right? That we'll help you with the different aspects of company building. The communication that would still be on like a one-on-one basis, working with the founders. Or is there a better way to do this?
Yeah, it's mostly one-on-one.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Shield.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to chat, Rahul.